KZSU, Stanford, 90.1 FM. I'm Mark Molyneux. This is the Henry George Program, show all about land, policy, and politics. During the program, we have on Christopher England, the historian and author of the book Land and Liberty, Henry George and the Crafting of Modern Liberalism, published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. And we're taking a tour of history today, talking in particular about the first several decades of the 20th century, a turning point in the movement of urban politics, reform politics, as Georgist reformers try to take on, quote-unquote, the interests. So we'll hear all about that and much more. But right now, let's just get to it. So Chris, thank you so much for being here on the program.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, so this work, it was legendary in certainly the online Georgist circles years before it was published in this very handsome edition. But the book is Land and Liberty, Henry George and the Crafting of Modern Liberalism, which was originally came out of your PhD thesis. But before we kind of get into kind of what's in it and what we're talking about here today, just maybe talk about the genesis of what brought you to this as your project.
You know, I came into George through labor history. I was interested in the history of the Knights of Labor, which was this really radical union in mid-19th century America called for a cooperative commonwealth. It's often seen as the juncture at which American unionism sort of splits off, where it could have gone on a leftward path, but the fall of the Knights of Labor takes it towards sort of bread and butter business unionism. And in my study of the Knights of Labor documents, I saw Henry George's single tax. And it was something that I had encountered in the historical record, but it had never played a major role in any of the narratives I had read. And so I was just curious, what is it that draws this major social movement to Henry George's ideas? At the time, most historical accounts saw George as kind of a backward-looking agrarian. You know, he talked about land, and so people saw that as maybe hearkening back to Jeffersonian ideas of, you know, everyone a yeoman farmer. And I went in imagining that was what it was, and that I was sort of trying to diagnose why this would be appealing to a labor union. And, you know, after a decent amount of research and some rethinking, I saw that it was actually something quite different. I saw that it was an urban movement about high rising rents and how to redistribute those rents to make sure that rather than creating poverty in the midst of progress, as, you know, George famously said in his book, Progress and Poverty, that rather those values could be used to create prosperity for all.
Yeah, so I think you can draw a important moment in the history of kind of George's influence versus Marx's influence after the Soviet Revolution. But even before that, I'm kind of curious, you know, as you're looking at labor history pre-1917, what was the general ebb and flow of Marx's influence? Because I think you're saying it in the Knights of Labor period, George really was the shining star. Certainly as an ideologue governing thought. You mentioned how this kind of splits into kind of the more self-centered, kind of less, you might even phrase some sorts of rent-seeking in the AFL. But I guess as far as kind of the, the ideological yeast in the movement, how do you see Marx and George coexisting pre-1917?
That's a good question. You know, I think that within the American labor movement, George is probably more significant than Marx. Marxism is an idea that takes hold amongst certain groups of workers, but it's, many Marxists are actually pushed out of the AFL, which is seen as, you know, business unionism and pushed towards more radical unions like the Industrial Workers of the World. The Knights of Labor are drawn to George because they see a tax on land as something that can split up monopolies, you know, can make sure that natural resources are either sold off or utilized, that can split up, you know, the power of railroad monopolies, which depend upon these vast expanses of rights of way. And that by doing this, they'll have the resources to, buy their own capital and establish their own cooperatives. So I think it is, quite important to the Knights of Labor's vision of a sort of a liberal cooperative economy. When George runs for mayor in 1886, Samuel Gompers, who founds the AFL, it campaigns for him, but kind of reluctantly. And he ultimately concludes that politics has divided the labor movement. The Knights of Labor face a backlash over their radical politics, and they get sort of pushed slowly out of existence over the coming years. Whereas Gompers draws workers into the AFL with the promise of higher wages and shorter work hours through strikes. Very pragmatic labor unionism. Now, Gompers has also read Marx, and he is influenced by Marx to the extent that he has accepted the idea of class conflict. He argues that class conflict is inevitable. Workers and bosses are always going to be fighting. On the other hand, he also projects the idea that the AFL is a bulwark against radicalism, that by, managing this conflict through collective bargaining, you are preventing, forestalling any sort of really fundamental change of the economic system. And in some ways, Gompers is, he's part of the broader Gilded Age faith in freedom of contract, that people should voluntarily be able to draw up their own contracts. And he says, well, the bosses do this. They come together into larger groups to get better terms, and that's what the workers are going to go do too. We're going to bargain collectively, collectively draw up our contracts. So, long story short, Marxism has an intellectual influence on American labor, certainly, but Georgism is at some point, foundational to pretty radical visions of labor unionism, and it comes back again in American labor by the teens when you see some practical experiments in land value taxation, creating construction and therefore jobs for people in the building trades. And Gompers comes back around to land value taxation and says, okay, maybe this is something that can benefit workers.
Yeah, it's it. And it reminds me of the article you wrote about the rise and fall of land value taxation in Vancouver. I think you see in the early days of Vancouver, certainly just building buildings was kind of seen in the public interest to, both bring wealth to the city, to bring affordability to the city. But as time went on, there was very much kind of a self-centeredness of certainly kind of the middle class movement inside labor to, really, keep more of the land wealth for themselves and less to see any kind of public benefit. But it's interesting you kind of see the last piece of that in the 19 teens, and I think that's kind of what we're going to get into today about the rise and fall and kind of what kind of came to a head in the 1910s. But
The example of Vancouver, it's Vancouver is seen as a place where land value taxation is, very successful. Vancouver grows rapidly. If you look at Vancouver today, it looks like what a single tax city should look like. It has very tall buildings in the center, and then it has nature on the outside. In reality, it's kind of hard to say what the impact of land value taxation was here, because Vancouver was growing anyway. People were moving out west. But most estimates are that it at least did encourage more rapid development. And after a certain point in time, by the 20s and 30s, people were complaining that there are more apartments than there are people to fill them. And you have homeowners who, don't want to pay taxes now. There's a sense that you have housing abundance and people no longer feel the imperative to pay or higher taxes in a way that might increase supply more. And so you see a slow winnowing down of land value taxation in Vancouver. higher rates that would be applied to, land and to expensive space are generally reduced relative to the value of the buildings over a period of time. They're not complaining about having too many houses now,
Yeah,
but
it's a problem to have too much abundance until it isn't. But
yeah.
yeah, some of the key themes in this book that you get into again and again, I think you can talk about. I mean, this book largely deals with the history of the Georgist movement. The book runs about 270 pages. George himself dies about page 90, so you see how much happens after that. And in fact, that is some of the most important actual political influence. And insofar as 1897 through 1920 had heavy influence, and that is in the mind the Progressive Era, there's kind of the ability to conflate the Georgist influence with the Progressive Era. But you repeatedly throughout find distinctions between kind of the ideological node of progressivism and the Georgists. So why don't you speak on that just a bit?
So, I mean, this is a complex topic because, progressivism doesn't really have any one meaning. It's applied to all sorts of different ideas. This is a moment where Americans of all stripes have their own ideas for change. And, sometimes Georgists would, single taxers would use the term progressive. But oftentimes they tended to instead lean on the terms liberal and radical, which are ideas that are sometimes seen as passé or out of style during the time. These are ideas that harken back to, the radicalism of sort of liberalism of John Stuart Mill, this idea that, you need to break up monopolies, but otherwise the free market can work on its own with some kind of help to make it more egalitarian through taxation, perhaps through workers' cooperatives. Conversely, you see a lot of Americans who become very disenchanted with those liberal ideas during this period. You see the rise of social Darwinism. America has this, great experiment in racial equality with in the area of Reconstruction. And then you see white terrorism pushing that back. And Americans lose faith in a lot of these ideas. And the language of individual rights and universal rights, which are, these classical liberal ideas, become kind of passe during the period. They come to be seen as antiquated, not really sort of tied to a reality of sort of increasing emphasis on genetic difference, biologically inherited traits. And so progressivism, again, it's a term that is used by many different people for many different reasons, but I think it's seen usually quite, the quintessential progressive group are these kind of middle class, often academics who are coming in with these ideas about sometimes social Darwinism, also extensive intervention government by experts. So you have the preceding liberal faith is sort of that the free market will work until it's proven that it doesn't. Whereas the progressive faith is sort of the opposite. Experts will usually have their correct solution and will apply order to chaos. Unless there's some reason to believe that those experts are not doing so. But generally there's this period of pretty boundless faith in government by experts. And Georgists aren't really part of that. They believe in the extension of public institutions, of particularly this idea that land is unique and needs to be socialized, and the value of that land can be used to create new public institutions like free higher education, free public transportation. But there's a sense that the Georgists believe that there are things that are innately public, monopolies, and government shouldn't extend, too far past those things. That there need to be boundaries between public and private, and balances of power between the state, and private entities.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to encounter that in the works of George. I think I struggle with it a bit myself, but when you talk about the progressivism and its embrace of, I'd say, you know, you might say a bureaucratic regulatory apparatus. It's very different. I mean, I think you can say, oh, if you oppose that, you must be for privatization and, you know, kind of the, you know, the neoliberal order. When it's a very strange sort of kind of vision, at least kind of by modern standards, George has, which is, you know, there should be a kind of chaotic order of private actors. You know, there should be, I mean, this could be everything from innovation to just kind of, you know, kind of just, you know, prickly, don't mess with me if I don't want it. But, you know, if something is necessarily a natural monopoly, you know, socialize it. And, you know, instead of having kind of, you know, kind of this piecemeal, you can look at everything from regulatory, you know, laws to perhaps a franchise system. Having kind of, you know, kind of a large sphere of public operations with its own, you know, democratic control, which I think that's kind of a big open question. How do you best do that? But there is very much this idea of a very bright line between public and private, as opposed to an encompassing, you know, public sphere, but kind of with loose hold on everything. And I think your overall thesis is they were one of the few folks for decades and decades drawing any attention to this bright line, and this kind of influenced, you know, how you'd say kind of a modern liberalism, you know, survived even through the New Deal into kind of the modern state. So it's an interesting history, I think, that isn't really kind of brought up much.
Yeah. So today, you know, challenging this kind of progressive, you know, faith and, you know, unbounded faith in government expertise might be seen as, you know, neoliberal or libertarian. But in reality, throughout the, you know, most of 20th century, following the progressive era, those ideas were pretty firmly repudiated. Liberalism emerges, the idea of New Deal liberalism emerges after the fall of progressivism, as most people, even many former progressives, say, you were awfully naive about this.
Yeah.
And, you know, the defining moment here is, of course, World War One, when people realize that, oh, the government can do things that are not particularly progressive, you know, that violations of freedom of speech become a major issue during World War One. And there's a sense that the government is now putting down many of these radical ideas, these ideas of change that progressivism had been about. You, of course, see, you know, backlash to Germans. You see the whole war fever. And there's suddenly a skepticism about the idea that the powers of state should be unbounded. And people, you see the rise of ACLU, which will, you know, begin to try cases in the Supreme Court that will start laying the foundations for rights-based liberalism, you know, limits on federal power. And Georgists would be, in a lot of ways, an intermediary here. They would be one of the few groups during the progressive era that would be, you know, consistently supporting free speech rights. They would be, you know, siding with, you know, radicals. There are even some sort of indirect ties into how, you know, Georgists managed to introduce Roger Baldwin, who becomes the founder of the ACLU, to Emma Goldman. Who persuades him that, you know, there need to be limits on government. Emma Goldman being this anarchist who is subject to prosecution when she speaks throughout the country. And this is a foundational moment in Roger Baldwin's career, when he transitions from, you know, an expertise-centered progressive to someone who will challenge state authority in a way that will ultimately set him up to begin pioneering the ACLU during World War One. So there are kind of connections in which Georgists have helped promote this line of freedom of speech, this idea that there are need to be restrictions on government power that would lay the foundation or support the rise of a liberalism in the middle 20th century that would, you know, expand the power of the government to help people economically, much as Georgists had wanted, but also restrict the powers of government to coerce people, much as George had also wanted.
Yeah, it's a funny anecdote you have here. Throughout, you have kind of there's all these moments in kind of, you might say state overreach or kind of illiberalism that are pushed back upon, kind of unusually principled Georgists in high post. I guess during the Red Scare at the tail end of World War One, you had Lewis Post push back against, kind of the purges done. At that time, but earlier you talk about Emma Goldman was regularly just her free speech was trampled on by all sorts of public officials, but the Georgist mayor Tom Johnson openly welcomed her to spout anarchist screeds, saying, "Yeah, this is the bedrock of a functioning democracy, is to allow anyone to say things like this," which is, I mean, I think there's a kind of point to the scoreboard of some moments that age well, everything from kind of that dedication to civil liberties, but also kind of, the principled opposition to eugenics and racist actions at a time, which that was not very popular, certainly within the Democratic Party. Yeah, I think this book, I mean, that touches on some of the overall themes, but I think the book is a chronology of the movement, and I think what's really interesting is the focus on the approach to politics. What powered it, what were they trying to achieve, and how within the confines of democracy as they saw it. And as you say, there is an actual commitment to the liberal ideas of democracy. But I think you over time you see everything from them using democracy, and then them fighting against democracy over and over again. And I think this kind of the struggles and the kind of some pragmatic corners that had to be cut, it's a very interesting political history. And I guess why don't you speak a bit about kind of, I guess how some of the Georgist insiders, view democracy, I guess from the beginning, and how this might have evolved.
Yeah, so George has a very optimistic view of democracy. Really, fundamentally, the single tax is seen as a way of salvaging democracy. There is a sense that economic inequality is dividing people up in a way that will make democratic government unsustainable. And so, land value taxation is an intervention that's supposed to rectify that. It's supposed to decrease the value of wealth that is dividing people by providing the economic foundations for something like a social safety net, or at least public utilities that will provide economic opportunity. And so Georgists become key figures in various movements towards improving democracy. George would become a vocal proponent of the secret ballot, for example. So up until this point, you get a ballot from the party official, and everyone knows who you're voting for. Voter intimidation is very common at the polls, as is bribing voters. George, fights for a secret ballot, and George has become major figures in establishing the secret ballot. They're oftentimes the people drafting the laws in the states that establish secret ballots. And then by the Progressive Era, Georgists also get involved in the fight for direct legislation, for referendums. But then they do so in partly for pragmatic reasons, because they recognize that with these referendums, they will be able to circumvent constitutional clauses that prevent land value taxation. Because most states have uniformity clauses in the Constitution saying everything has to be taxed the same amount. And so, because referendums, change the Constitution at the same time, they can, in one fell swoop, establish their tax.
Yeah.
And in that, you see that Georgists are both, they believe in democracy and making politics as accessible as possible, but at the same time, they're also thinking about politics pragmatically. And there's also a tension that I think probably going to be inherent to any democratic movement, with very clearly defined ideals, is that they have an idea that they want to see in practice. It's very specific, and politics isn't always going to play out that way. And for many, many years, you see people fighting these battles, and sometimes they lose those battles, and they reconcile it emotionally by saying, well, the people learn more every time they vote. We are still moving in the right direction. But after the 19 teens, it's clear that they're not. And it's clear that the single tax is going by the wayside after World War I. And that's when a lot of people fall either into various types of depression, disillusionment with the single tax, or in some cases, disillusionment with democracy. I mean, there's not that many people, I think, break with democracy. You have Albert J. Nock, who would become a founding figure in libertarianism. He says, well, if the people, aren't going to vote for the single tax, then the people can't be trusted to vote, because this is the system that is right according to natural law.
Yeah, there's a big range of how cracked people became about the New Deal, and the people who became extremely angry and cracked about it. I mean, went some pretty dark places. I mean, you look at Knox later stuff where he just, was essentially a Nazi sympathizer because he was so angry at FDR. Not good, but I think yeah, he's kind of a he and a few other folks are in their own weird node.
Yeah, Nock is, I think, pretty exceptional. I don't, most of them didn't go that far. And Georgists have a variety of responses to the New Deal. Many of them see a little bit of their ideas in the New Deal, and that the New Deal has, a heavy focus on government ownership of resources and utilities. Take, for example, the Tennessee Valley Authority. But they don't like, in particular, they really don't like the NRA, the National Recovery Administration, which is trying to do economic planning on the national level. It's not doing it well. It falls by the wayside. But many P Georgia see this as sort of expert intervention writ large. And one of the Georgists who's closest to Roosevelt is George Peabody. Who's a longtime Democratic political activist. He introduces Roosevelt to his Warm Springs estate in Georgia, that would be kind of as Roosevelt would popularize for polio recovery. But Peabody is a close personal friend of Roosevelt, and he supports him in many ways. But he's also keeps on running into issues that he has with him. And as the last years of his life, he very strongly tries to press the single tax on Roosevelt. And he says that if the NRA stays in existence, after Roosevelt leaves office, businesses are going to capture it and is going to move the country into fascism. Of course, the NRA ends up being voided by the Supreme Court, and New Dealers don't really want to bring it back because it wasn't a very successful policy. So you see a whole range of responses. Most Georgists will find something that they like about the New Deal and stick with it for a few years, but then usually grow more and more distant, and eventually split, sometimes very acrimoniously, so other times not so much. But
Yeah, I mean, you could look at some of the policies are like almost anti-Georgist, explicitly. I mean, the way they kind of subsidized, mortgages or the risk of mortgages was certainly, not ideal in the long term. But especially the AAA is the Agricultural Adjustment Act, right? Like it's basically just a just slap for landowners. That was pretty ugly. But one of the big ironies, I think, is just kind of the fact that for George himself, being a greenbacker back before it was a fringe position, you didn't really get any sort of innovative macroeconomic policies for money, which I think was desperately needed during the Great Depression. I mean, I think as far as Keynes came from kind of influenced by Gesell, who was influenced by George, you didn't really get that same throughput of the George Gesell money-based Georgists until kind of the post-Keynesians, you know, years and years later. But strange to me, like, you don't hear anything from the Greenbackers at a time when I think their voice would have become, you know, extremely relevant.
Yeah, you know, George, you know, talked a little bit about money, but not too much. You know, it wasn't an issue that he saw as particularly vital. But he believed, you know, in a very modern conception of money, which is that, you know, it could be fiat and you could print paper money and that would be far more efficient. Behind the scenes, he worked with his close associate, Tom Johnson, to introduce legislation in the 1880s for interconvertible bonds, which would be, you know, bonds that would also back currency. So he is, you know, involved in some schemes to expand the money supply, which is something that you know, farmers at the time are very much want, because the country is moving in a lot of ways towards the gold standard. There's, you know, restriction in currency and prices are going down and they're finding it hard to pay back their loans. But it was not something that he particularly emphasized or that his followers really carried on in a way, in a really salient way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thread wasn't really picked up until, you might say, like, you know, Vickrey and Gaffney almost, you know, a century, you know, later.
I mean, I think part of this might just be related to historical context. You know, in the 1890s, there are sort of discoveries of gold in the West that, you know, alleviate the shortage of currency. And so it's just not seen as salient an issue. And so that might be why Georges sort of let it fall by the wayside, is because it just didn't seem to be as significant anymore.
That's interesting. But we're talking about the, you know, New Deal era. And at that point, I mean, I think you could say the influence or just the sheer numbers of real true believers was at low tide, a low tide that, you know, basically kind of went on through the rest of the 20th century. But it's very interesting to kind of compare that to essentially right after George's death. You know, this is 1897. A big part of the book is basically 1897 to 1919, which coincidentally are the years that the public, you know, a major George's publication of note, which you know, poured through to do your research for this. But, you know, at the time of his death, there's so many people who are like inner circle colleagues and, you know, people who worked with George, but just so many more people who were influenced. It was just an incredible bench of extremely competent, motivated folks in politics, you know, people with great abilities of communication, a lot of them centered in Ohio, which, you know, became a node of influence at the municipal level. It's very interesting. I think that kind of a major dynamic you point at is, I guess, the Georgist solution in a lot of ways is overcoming, quote unquote, the interests. And politically, that's difficult to do because it's a well-known problem that special interests are extremely motivated to do things against the public will. It's very, very hard to overcome that when most people just don't care about boring stuff. And one of the ways that was addressed to kind of overcome the interest at this time, especially when you know, had a kind of a node in a place like Cleveland, is, you know, a large number of charismatic and dedicated folks. Could this be the solution to politics? Just, you know, have, you know, famous faces, very dedicated, competent faces, doing everything from educating the public to even, you know, executive power through something that, you know, may not be, you know, strictly, you know, kosher. It's very interesting. I think that was, for really part of its history, that you can call it maybe a cult of personality in some ways, you know, with many people, but it certainly was the driving political strategy to a large degree. So why don't you speak on that a bit and kind of say, you know, maybe kind of where that headed.
Yeah. So I think, you know, part of the factor here is that, you know, Georgism is a philosophy that is, you know, meant to appeal in a large way to people who are sort of up and coming. You know, the idea is that it's great to succeed. It's great to make things and have your own income. But wealth is inherited wealth, existing wealth is often an obstacle to that in terms of high land prices, high land values. And so it draws upon a group of people who are very motivated, sometimes have, difficult childhoods in various ways, are people of, adaptability in urban areas, sometimes in communications, and are drawn to these ideas with, deep emotional commitment that really compels them to put their all into this. William Urend, who would go on to establish direct legislation in Oregon, he had gone to Hawaii and planned to kill himself until he read Progress and Poverty and decided to devote his life to that. I mean,
Because
so
he was
this is
essentially dying of TB, right? Is that right? Or like he was in extremely poor health in some way. I forget exactly how. Yeah.
think from his time working in the coal mines.
Yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, it's an idea that speaks to people in a really powerful way and develops a devoted cadre of people who get involved in municipal politics and build reputations, not just for being single taxers, but for fighting for people's interests in a municipal system, in which most people are crooks. I mean, urban governments are, just fraught with crime at the time.
Yeah.
And so they pull on, pretty broadly kind of sort of populist appeals about their ability to represent people. They deliver in terms of oftentimes establishing higher taxes that will then go on to support, services that people desperately need. And so they build political regimes around them. And this is very effective at giving them the authority to fight issues that are hard to fight. There's the kind of logic behind rent seeking is that by and large, the smaller your group is, the more you are committed to obtaining special benefits for it. Land prices is something or something that detrimentally impacts a large group of people, renters in small ways, and positively benefits other people, owners in often a smaller group in a very big way. So it creates a group of very committed people and versus a public that is not necessarily always as committed to fighting against rents. But sort of these political regimes, these machines sometimes that they build are highly effective at mobilizing against many of these issues.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. I mean, you could say that it started at the urban level, or certainly that became the node through like Cleveland as being the shining example. A ton of of people who ended up controlling Cleveland politics for years with a program of public ownership of streetcars, railroad reform, kind of a more humane form of policing and other things. But it's interesting that as this kind of went on, the you trace how it ceases to be a purely municipal level, partly because that's constrained from everything from a lack of home rule. How do we fix that? And there's kind of larger, more ambitious efforts to deal with it at higher levels, largely state level referenda, and to both do home rule and direct LVT. This was financed through some of the big pockets. Every time that Georgism would catch a big fish, sometimes you just make a true believer as someone who is already very wealthy for other reasons, which was very good to kind of launch ambitious projects. But I think this is kind of at least one step in which I think you saw, yeah, I guess the end of education as being possible. You mentioned earlier, like, when George wrote this as a popular kind of, he wanted to influence people, but he certainly didn't dumb down his prose or anything. He trusted that the working man, the everyman, can read, can think. But I think as time went on, I think maybe that kind of faith was tested by the fact that people just wouldn't get that motivated over the abstractions of home rule and taxation assessment reform. When you're fighting against the special interests of farmers, and I think this led to some massive disasters in places like you know, Missouri and especially California. So I guess you could say that's kind of the end of maybe, I guess, the last great wave of ambitious politics in any sort of direct way. But yeah, why don't you speak on kind of aspects of that strategy a bit?
Yeah, so I think the paradox here is that land value taxation is an idea that dates back to economics, more or less. You know, I mean, you know, some of the earliest economic ideas, you know, merging with Adam Smith and all of that, you know, what would one would consider modern economics, embrace some element of land value taxation, but it's an idea that hasn't always had too much salience. There have been popular campaigns around it in England and Australia, but George was, you know, was seemingly quite special in that he built a very large and very committed grassroots movement for it. People were intensely devoted to it during his lifetime. And I think, you know, part of that is a function of him as a person, as a motivating speaker, as also someone who came from, you know, hardship and sort of was able to challenge many of the kind of great thinkers of the time without much in the way of formal training. But I think there's also something about the way in which he communicated quite intentionally to make what was everyone else sees as a very technocratic issue of taxation into a really clear and profound moral issue.
Yeah.
And he does it across an array of spectrums. He is very adept at building out arguments to appeal to all sorts of different people for all different sorts of reasons. You know, he will be making theological arguments based off of Hinduism and condemnations of poverty in Hinduism. He will be making Christian arguments. He will also famously be making arguments about how the socialization of land is a key principle of the Jewish faith because of its the idea of the Jubilee in ancient Israel, this redistribution of land that's meant to occur every 50 years. And this is a profoundly influential idea outside of his own community. He delivers this address to a Jewish organization in San Francisco. He manages to, you know, one of his most important supporters is Joseph Fels, who is, you know, a wealthy Jewish man who funds George's programs throughout the world. And, you know, this idea, this argument takes root in the Zionist movement. And if you know, Israel today ostensibly has social ownership of land in part because of these arguments and the influence of Georgism in the Zionist movement. So this is a way in which, you know, he's thinking outside of his own ethical framework, thinking about very, very consciously of, you know, the religious and ethical frameworks of other peoples and, you know, building arguments that will be persuasive to expand his audience. And, you know, taking these ideas about taxation and making them into, you know, profound and powerful religious arguments. So this is the thing that other people talking about this issue had typically missed. And I think people today, even who are talking about this or other similar rent-seeking issues, have a harder time doing, translating, you know, these very practical technocratic arguments into moral arguments. But then again, I guess most of us don't believe in natural law anymore. some of these arguments would not be as persuasive nowadays.
People still believe in good and bad. I think you just need to find the right way to reach them. Not through, I think, you know, a dedicated idea of rights or even kind of, you know, an objective morality per se. But yeah, I think getting back, just a sideline, it is kind of interesting to talk about. I mean, kind of, there's a lot of talk about kind of the history of Zionism. Was it necessarily colonial from the beginning? But there certainly were threads which were kind of more utopian and pluralistic. And it seems like the Georgists who are in the Zionist movement seem to really kind of believe in, oh, yeah, I certainly want, you know, Jewish people to be able to, you know, go to their homeland if they want, but seemingly with more of a pluralistic kind of idea of land sharing among different people as opposed to kind of an ethno-nationalist aspect. I mean, I think that doesn't really represent everybody, but that was certainly a thread I was picking up when I read about kind of some of the, you know, Zionist versus, you know, Georgist overlap at that time. Have you gotten much into that material, I guess, aside of what we cover in this book?
Yeah, so, you know, I haven't gone that much deeper than what you see in the book. But yeah, the Fels do seem to have an idea for Israel that is more pluralistic. They don't see, they see it as a homeland for Jews, but not necessarily as a Jewish state. And they're even conscientious of, you know, talking about, you know, land value taxation as something that the Jews can establish amongst themselves, but that non-Jews, you know, should have the option of whether or not they would adopt it. Conversely, you do have, you know, Zionists who seem to be adopting the idea of land value taxation specifically because, you know, less secure land rights could be used to encourage displacement.
It's a tool that can be used if your goal is just acquiring land. Yeah, that is yeah. a key tool in the box.
Yeah, so, you know, I think a Georgist approached Zionism with not a very anti-colonial perspective, or not a colonial perspective, but I think some Zionist approached Georgism as potentially a tool of colonialism. So, you know, it's complex, but
I think it goes to, like, it's, yeah, the history of anti-imperialism inside the Georgist movement. I mean, the Spanish American War is being like an incredible sort of alignment of folks against McKinley, you know, and going full force into the Democratic Party. It's interesting because I think, you know, I think in the history of, as, you know, kind of aggressive American military power goes on the 20th century, the kind of the history of the anti-imperialist, you know, left as it was, you know, circa 1900 is kind of a forgotten page in history, but they certainly seem to care a lot about opposing the U.S., you know, shoving its weight around and acquiring the Philippines.
Yeah, you know, many Georgists would have roots in abolitionism. They would see Georgism as kind of the next step in ensuring free labor, and because of that, so, you know, most had some sort of background for the Republican Party, maybe were leery of the Democratic Party, but many of those will come over to the Democratic Party after the Spanish American War, like William Lloyd Garrison II, you know, son, yeah, of the famous abolitionist. You know, Georgism has this early basis in anti-colonialism because the first major constituency to join the movement were the Irish, who, yeah, saw it as a way of reclaiming their land from English landlords. And, you know, there's even kind of there's this sort of nationalistic idea that the land should belong to the people and the nation as a whole. So there's always a connection there between Georgism and anti-imperialism, which is quite strong.
Yeah. So back to the chronology, where we've kind of gotten through the kind of failed referenda of that era, and we're in, you know, kind of getting to World War One. And I think this is interesting because I think before I read through your work originally, I guess I had no conception that the Wilson administration was so important, or at least was such an interesting high watermark, which is to say kind of the influence across the public had, you know, has started to recede tremendously. But at the same time, you saw a ton of extremely key Georgist figures, Lewis Post already mentioned, but Newton Baker as the Secretary of War, become, you know, heavily involved in the Wilson administration, which seems like a weird fit insofar as we talked before about how a lot of the kind of eugenics threads of the progressive movement had, you know, kind of not aligned with the Georges in a lot of ways. But I think just due to the fact that they became kind of power brokers to a large degree within the Democratic Party, they got seats at the table, and they said, "Well, I guess, you know, if you get a chance like this, you got to take it." And it's really interesting that this was a high water mark, but also essentially a dead end for the Georges movement. So, why don't you talk a bit about, you know, kind of what went on within the Wilson administration?
Yeah, so, you know, Georges have built up these Democratic machines in cities, many of which had been historically Republican. And Wilson is making an effort to bring urban areas into the Democratic Party, which had historically been a very agrarian party. And he's often doing so by moving to the left. I mean, he's also courting socialists with the masses. So, you know, he is appealing to urban leftists, and Georges have influence in many of the places that he needs to win, and so they enter into his administration. You know, Wilson is a very tough nut to crack. I mean, he has a long history of saying plenty of racist things, but when he campaigns in 1912, he adopts, you know, a very egalitarian position. He's says that he's changed his mind on immigration, that he's going to offer fair dealings with African Americans. Famously, W.B. Du Bois, the great, you know, black civil rights activist, endorses Wilson. So in 1912, he actually looks like a racial progressive, one of the more racially progressive people at the time, potentially, and strangely so coming from the Democratic Party. Of course, that does not work out.
Yeah. You say 1912. It's interesting that Teddy Roosevelt, you know, running again at that time, still seems to be kind of a beacon of progressivism. But you know, certainly as it was being assessed by the Georges movement, he was seen as kind of being anti-democratic, a more paternal figure at the time, which is, I feel, not how he's remembered, certainly in the kind of Bull Moose, you know, movement.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Roosevelt's also a very complex figure. You know, he is closely tied to this sort of progressive middle class. He is, you know, a supporter of, you know, he's obviously a trust buster, but he doesn't believe in breaking up all big businesses. You know, he famously separates the good from the bad trust, and he's trying to, you know, use government to bring monopolies into a more moral position to take care of workers. You know, he's not necessarily anti-bigness. He wants to make sure that government is there to ensure that business works, that these new big monopolies work in the public interest. Whereas Georgists are usually thinking more about breaking up monopoly, not necessarily through antitrust, but through establishing policies that are going to create a more level playing field. And that's where Wilson is too, through tariff reduction, that it's going to create more competition for trust through monetary reform. So they gravitate towards Wilson on those issues. You know, tariff, free trade is an important policy for Georgist, and Wilson is moving in that direction. Of course, you know, Roosevelt is a very complex figure on many of these issues as well. He famously, you know, talks about race suicide, the idea that native-born Americans are not having enough children. There are elements of egalitarianism in his thought. He, you know, famously invites the black leader, Booker T. Washington, to dine with him in the White House, which creates enormous controversy. But, you know, he always has a very strongly racialist view of politics and society. He believes that certain people from all backgrounds can become part of this American melting pot. but he's not really egalitarian.
Yeah, you mentioned kind of like the successes that I say the Georgist wing of the Wilson administration achieved insofar as they influenced, more kind of egalitarian influences on the tax code. I mean, it's kind of an irony that they're remembered as the single taxers, but in fact were behind kind of the modern progressive income tax, originally an excess profits tax, to fund the First World War. Also kind of combined with kind of seeing land reform as part of liberal interventionism, and as you said earlier, kind of the way of taking on kind of modern labor policy, which you kind of group together as industrial democracy. And I think it's interesting to kind of say what went well and what went badly in the Wilson administration. But I think those are the things that I think, if you look at what they wanted to achieve, that seems, they checked a few boxes.
Yeah, I mean, they do have influence. Frank Walsh, who's a single taxer, would be important in sort of popularizing the idea of industrial democracy. And during World War One, he would work with the federal government to ensure their workers had representation in industries with war contracts, which would ultimately, historian Joseph McCartan has argued, lay the foundation for, oddly enough, sort of kind of employer representation programs in the post-war period. since the government had sort of imposed these models of industrial democracy, the employers felt like they needed to do something to appease workers who had been offered these things. And so these kind of internal representation systems that you see in some corporations, kind of a descendant of this. You see, probably most significantly, Georgists are working to sort of socialize the public domain. The federal government owns lots of land, but it's had a policy of just selling it or giving it away. And Georgists want to lease it out so that you have something like land value taxation on the federal level. It's not taxation, it's direct leasing. But the idea is that the government is taking the wealth, the land rent, and making it public one way or the other. And they managed to be relatively successful in this and pushing legislation that will lay the foundation for leasing of public domain for natural resources, which is a natural resource extraction, which would be a policy that is still around today. So there are a variety of ways in which Georgists managed to get things out of the Wilson administration, but of course, they don't get everything they want. I mean, really, the issues were always mostly local issues, and even in the Wilson administration, they understood that and acted accordingly. Henry George Jr. is a congressman, and in from 1912 to 1914, he's fighting mostly for issues of taxation and traction ownership, streetcar ownership in D.C., which is under the purview of Congress because it's federal property. So even in the national government, their focus is kind of on local government.
That's interesting.
That's really where their interests lie.
I wonder, like, kind of as a sideline, before we talk about kind of the decline, right after or kind of around this time, kind of the future of the labor movement at this point, because the U.S. got into the level of kind of shop-based unionism, increasingly siloed and kind of its own thing, kind of further limited by, Taft-Hartley and everything else. But I mean, you kind of wonder, like, the Georgist vision, insofar as you mentioned time and again, there is certainly an allergy to just kind of regulating big business per se. I'm not sure I would call it kind of an allergy to bigness. I think, George himself, he loved big cities. He loved the kind of idea of agglomerations. But, how does this really, what is the end goal? You mentioned earlier, I think, George himself said he'd want to see more cooperatives. is there a future of like Americans, you know, the labor movement, which has more of a place for big cooperatives? I don't know if that's kind of the Francoist, you know, Mondragon vision or something, or like, is there more of a rule of kind of the more European style of sectoral bargaining, but with like less of maybe I'd say the kind of combative, you know, siloed structure? I don't know. I'm just trying to think, like, what would the future of a more Georgist labor movement in the 20th century in America look like if there really was, you know, kind of the muscle behind it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, one thing that I think, you know, there's the idea of cooperatives, and, you know, this is something that is, you know, played out in, you know, Sweden, I think, has a very high percentage of industrial cooperatives. You know, aside from that, George and the Knights of Labor, they tended to view the function of labor unions as not being just about strikes, but also about political influence. Mm. Ultimately, the Knights of Labor were organizing politically. At their great upheaval, where they're staging strikes across the country, they're also running labor officials throughout the country. Their goal is to unite workers as a political unit to enact policy, to influence Republican government. And so one of the ideas here is a kind of labor republicanism about political influence. And that's obviously an idea that does come back around again. The AFL is not consistently involved in politics during the Progressive Era, but then in the New Deal, you see the rise of the Congress of Industrial Organizations. You would see Sidney Hellman, who would actually be brought to some of these ideas by Clarence Darrow, a famous Georgist, who would be persuaded that the role of unions should be to influence politics. Mm. Sidney Hellman then goes on to found the Political Action Committee, the original PAC,
yeah,
to help support Franklin Roosevelt. So, you know, that idea comes back around, and I think is still very much with us. You know, the one thing that comes into this equation is question of industrial democracy, which is something that the Georgist Frank Walsh is a big proponent of, and becomes, you know, is picked up by the public. And industrial democracy is a bit of a amorphous concept, but it's generally understood to be about introducing this idea of democracy into the workplace with worker representation around questions of production, about the workforce should not be entirely top down Taylor's professional management, but workers should be able to have a voice. And of course, that is, you know, an important function of many labor unions today, that they provide workers with representation and agency within the workplace. But I'm not sure if in practice it rises to the level that advocates of industrial democracy hope for, but I think it is there currently.
That's interesting. Okay, but now we get to, I guess, the sad denouement of everything, which is kind of the overall decline and, you know, kind of entire irrelevance starting in 1920 or so. And I think, you know, you kind of list the major precipitating factors. And I think you could look at everything from the Soviet Revolution, which kind of certainly gave the left, per se, a more kind of obvious node to rally around, which, you know, certainly became the beacon and, you know, continues even to this day. You mention, you know, kind of the blowback from, you know, the kind of liberal interventionism of Wilson kind of really hurt everyone involved pretty badly. You mention the overall ideology of economic dictum of ability to pay being the main factor of what is good taxation. Before we get to those, and I think the big one, which is kind of regionalism, sprawl, cars, why don't you talk a bit about, you know, those three, but I think especially the ability to pay as kind of an ideological node, because you follow this growth throughout, and it really kind of, you know, I think people still chant it to this day without really even arguing why it is, you know, kind of a valid axiom to build upon.
Yeah, so good questions. So, you know, the rise of the The Bolshevik Revolution is important both in that it sort of takes the wind out of the sails of Georgism as a, as another sort of utopian solution appears to have it achieved its destiny. Marx had predicted this, and now it has come true. This legitimates those ideas. But in addition to that, it also means that there is a growing concern about subversion in the United States. You have the Red Scare, and Georgists are in this terrible position in which they are they're not attracting the interest of the left as much anymore now that there's this other idea out there, but they are attracting the interest of the right, which often labels them as communist for having these economically unorthodox ideas. So they're kind of getting it from both sides as a result of this. Some of the people who Lewis Post, who had been one of Henry George's close associates and the kind of leading sort of writer of the movement after his death, he spends his last years without much direction or acceptance anywhere. He's being, called a communist by some people. He's, marginalized because of his role in the Wilson administration and the fact that he has decided to not to deport people who had been accused of being communist. So he's suspicious to many on the right. And then you have the question of ability to pay. And ability to pay seems like a pretty obvious idea in many ways. The idea that you should pay according to income, your ability, the liquid assets you have at hand in order to pay taxes. This is not obvious in the United States prior to the rise of this idea, beginning in the 1880s, 1890s, because most American taxes are based off of wealth. They're property tax, taxes on real estate, but also taxes on movable wealth, just things you have in your household. The result is that sometimes people have trouble paying their taxes. There are all sorts of downsides of that potentially. People can be foreclosed on if they can't pay their taxes. But in shifting the taxation from wealth to income, that means that wealth becomes sacred. You can accumulate as much property as you want. It's oftentimes not subject to taxation. This is famously Thomas Piketty has written Capital in the 21st Century, in which he argues for a wealth tax because wealth is constantly accumulating into the hands of some, and this imbalance in wealth ownership is creating economic inequality. And this seems like an unintentional side effect of the income tax, but in a lot of ways it was in fact intentional. I mean, the people who supported ability to pay were sometimes decided opponents of Henry George, whose idea was to use taxes to redistribute wealth. That is kind of the fundamental idea here, that you should be able to keep the things that you earn, but this wealth that you've purchased or that you've inherited, you should have some pressure to actually use it. The taxes should be imposed on it to make sure that it's not idle. And that if it is, it'll be reallocated to someone who will utilize it.
Yeah, it's a weird kind of thing. It's like ability to pay, but if someone with great wealth, even if it's not liquid, they have the ability to pay. They have the wealth, but like that's never included. But it is interesting. I mean, it's the 17th Amendment is the income tax one, right? The 17th Amendment, we're dealing with that now of the fact that, it has the federal ability to tax income, but not wealth, insofar as, if you can't use mark-to-market valuations per se, you can maybe squint a lot and say, oh, maybe imputed rents are income, but I mean, that's its own can of worms. It is gonna like it is like was there a Georgist effort to try to allow, at least not so much foreclosing upon anything but income as far as that amendment went? Because I mean, we're still dealing with the kind of constraints of that to this day.
I'm not aware of Georgists being active in the crafting of the amendment in any way. They come, a lot of Georgists come into Congress shortly after the amendment makes its way through Congress. So I don't know anyone who was involved in it. And afterwards, Georgists are thinking about how to deal with it. They're optimistic that it could be interpreted to allow for the taxation of wealth. But when they get Wilson to kind of investigate it, he sends the question off to the attorney general, and the response is to the negative, that it's probably actually not possible under interpretations of the 17th Amendment to tax wealth. And this kind of is the catalyst for them to go more towards leasing, to think about leasing the public domain as a way to collect that land rent instead. And that's the way in which the New Deal builds with expansion of leasing, Tennessee Valley Authority, purchasing of land. I don't know that they had any influence over crafting the amendment, but
That's interesting.
they recognized that it didn't really serve their purposes. They hoped better, but it was pretty clear that it wasn't going to enable
Funny.
them to accomplish much.
So I think, and well, and finally, as far as the marks against it or the kind of factors, is the kind of just ability of urban issues and the fact that the car transformed everything, in the way that George in his writings would talk about kind of the railroad and streetcars would open up cities, but not that much. But the car really completely changed the way the law of rent worked within cities. And I think you can talk about any reform movement. It's always interesting to talk about the, I guess, tension per se between like reforms and ameliorations that you could introduce that would help people, but the danger that those reforms would also undermine your movement, if you actually take away the energy. And I think it's a kind of a big question for the Georgist movement over the course of decades up to this, which is if better transportation would open up land, should you do it if you know it's going to undermine the forces that kind of support Georgism? And it reminds me of, Peter Witt, one of the Cleveland folks. He was active in Cleveland politics into the 1930s. He was kind of the last legs of the Tom Johnson machine. Like he was in the 1920s talking about he wanted to take taxes off of personal automobiles, which is like it's very interesting for Georgists to say like you're really undermining kind of the urban core of political energy of this movement. But you could say if you just want to help people, if the automobile-based sprawl did make the average person much richer for decades. And I guess that's kind of a question for, I guess, what have you seen is like, did people ever predict how much of an influence that this kind of transportation would have on cities in the long term? And I guess kind of how did people deal with, should we just get behind it as reform versus can we resist it? I don't know. How do you view all that?
Yeah, I think most Georgists in the end went along with it. I think you see the rise of movements toward Georgism would in some ways feed into in its later years regionalism, policies of expanding outside of the city. Regionalists would often talk about Georgist ideas and arguing for land utilization that would just decrease rents by dispersing population. The old core of Georgists, they recognize that their policies aren't as relevant, that people were moving out of the cities. There doesn't seem to be as much of a drive to live in the cities, and they start looking elsewhere for different types of land reforms, including for things that in some ways sometimes would anticipate New Deal support for suburbanization. Frederick Howe, for example, proposed support of private land ownership, like loans. And so they didn't see it coming, but when it was clear that the automobile was eroding the city as they knew it. They accepted that this was a possibility for a way to deal with inequality around urban rents. And you know, by the 20s and 30s, you do see people who are looking to Georgism as embracing this life. The famous architect Frank Lloyd Wright, he would consider himself a Georgist. Anyway, he would associate it with a vision of complete decentralization, where everyone, were
Yeah,
able to.
I was going to bring it up if you didn't. Broadacre City is just that's a wild, it's basically a book he wrote on it, and it's just like he was looking at kind of modern exurban developments in like the way that like everyone like just hates now, but he's like, this is the future and I love it. And it's just such a weird vision. But he like I'll give him credit. He was an ideologue who saw what he wanted and was not afraid to talk about it, He loved the car.
I mean, it did for a while accomplish what George just wanted to see. That it accomplished lower rents, lower land prices, and as a potentially as a result, the rise of a more middle class country, a middle class country that would be solidly in support of liberal democracy during, some of the great travails of liberal democracy during the Cold War. But now that plan seems to have played out to its limits. There's not much more space outside of cities. Land prices are rising again.
I wonder who the first, who was the first, I guess, Georgist per se, who looked at the law of rent and suburban sprawl and predicted basically what we've gotten into, which is at some point, you sprawl as much as you can. You can't sprawl forever. And I suppose if it's 1920 and you say you can't sprawl forever, I think people would say, like, I don't care what happens in 80 years. But, someone has got to say, like, in the long term, this is imprudent. But I'm not sure if I've seen myself many people talking about the long term, in the early 20th century.
I mean, I think in some ways George himself did, in Progress and Poverty, he looked at the history of the frontier and he said, yes, this could happen again. You could open up new land and that would deal with some of the questions of inequality around land. But ultimately, the frontier gets filled in. Space is not infinite. Ultimately, you end up back in the same place. And so I think in some ways, he wasn't thinking about it in terms of transportation exactly, but he did realize that sure, introduction, ease of access to new land would deal with some of these issues, but not permanently.
Yeah, I think he even says, like, he mentions in terms of the streetcar, because he's not predicting the automobile per se, but he says, oh, yeah, it will open up land, but it will kind of get filled in. And he kind of implies almost immediately. I think I think if you said over the course of a century, it'll get filled in even with massively innovative technology, that would be true. Although I'm not sure if people say 100 years is like, I really care what's going to happen in 100 years. But I think the broad strokes of those dynamics are out there. But yeah, I think you talk about kind of, I mean, I think the rise and the fall, and then as you were speaking earlier, kind of the new emergence of relevance, which has to do a lot with urban unaffordability. And I think this goes to, as we said, like earlier, circa 1900, there's a huge bench of Georgists. There's a lot of competent people who are motivated and ideologically aligned. But, from 1920 on, I just think the biggest issue is there weren't new Georgists being created, to a large degree. You get a few oddballs and cranks, but in a few, kind of esteemed academics. The fact that inner cities just emptied out. It seemed like that certainly seemed to kill, you might say, the historical materialist drive, which is that, the ideology, what sits below it is material conditions. And I think you might say Georgism like could have a more well sketched out idea of kind of the influence of material conditions on ideology. But in practice, I think you can definitely look at the effect of the number of Georgists and the effect of like urban issues. And I think that certainly is, why you'd see so much, renewed relevance today. But I mean, I guess, you know, looking back at this history, how does this, you know, have you look at neo-Georgism in the 21st century?
Yeah, so Georgism does fall into a decline, and then, you know, there are a handful of institutions. There's the Henry George School of Social Science, but you know, it I think it's harder to it seemed to be detached from a lot of the conditions that people were concerned about. I think Georgists during that period tended to talk in terms of natural rights about how this is Lockean ideas of you get what you make, you don't make land, and therefore you shouldn't be able to keep the value of land. So this was an abstract moral proposition. It didn't really, you know, coincide with people's economic conditions or, you know, speak to them in a way that was meaningful. Now you have, you know, much more intense concern about urban rents, and also, you know, the desire to, you know, do infill for environmental reasons so that, you know, car use is less prevalent. You have all of these reasons to utilize tools that will promote denser urbanization. And so land value taxation is, again, newly relevant. It is, I think, much more technocratic right now. Its appeal is, you know, particularly strong amongst people with economic backgrounds, college-educated people, programmers. I'm not sure it's really clear how you sort of introduce George's really emotional appeals into the present. You know, I mean, so I think the...
I certainly see a thread of, I think, a lot of people who, you know, I think essentially, I mean, as far as the biggest emotional impact, it's reading George himself, which I think remains relevant, mm-hmm. and becoming very kind of like, you know, scales off their eyes and very moved, but still who put on a technocratic face. You know, I think like being honest about being moved, I think, isn't looked upon that well among, I guess, like circles of respectability per se.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah. But actually, I mean, before we wrap up, also, I'm just kind of curious about your process of going through the archives of, I mean, of, among many other things, The Public, you know, which, you know, had 20 years or so of publication, which was, I mean, that as well as other publications, namely the Single Tax Review, there was so much material put out there. And I'm just kind of curious, like, one, what was your process? Did you just read issue after issue after issue, or did you target certain topics, or how'd you go at that?
Yeah, I did a lot of reading.
Sure.
But, you know, really, I started in the archives going through the papers of Lewis Post. And then from there, I worked to sort of see who was connected through these private letters and kind of what they were doing behind the scenes. You know, The Public was not where I started because, I mean, in a lot of, you know, The Public tells this, you know, great story of the history of Georgism, but it was not a story that coincided with anything that anyone had ever written. So I kind of thought Lewis Post was exaggerating a lot of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, I went through the archives and I saw kind of the foundation for this. I saw, you know, the letters establishing these connections and some of the things that they were doing behind the scenes. And it was only, you know, later after I had the correspondence behind me that I really went back to The Public and, you know, kind of appreciated that it was a pretty accurate account of what was happening. And in a lot of ways, a great history in the making of recording the activities of the movement.
Yeah, everything from, yeah, news items to op-eds. I mean, they're dense publications and well formatted. Like they're pretty impressive. You know, all the different journals are out there, which I think kind of goes to the question of, you know, I think it's really interesting. You talk about the new movements today. I think it's facilitated through modern, convenient communications. But it also means that, you know, how people communicate tends to be in very ephemeral forms. You know, I think that I feel bad for the historians of tomorrow insofar as they are very unlikely to be able to read, for example, Twitter group messages, which I think are, you know, would be an excellent form of history, but unlike, you know, correspondence, are probably not going to be preserved. I mean, maybe they will, but and there certainly isn't the gloss on modern journals to that extent, largely because they're not as functional. I think you look at the public, that was the best way for people to basically have correspondence, kind of work out discourse. Now you just yell at people in kind of forums that, you know, probably won't last very long. But it is pretty cool that that journals that look that nice and are still great to read used to be the main format for that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the public was, it was well regarded by many people in the press, but it was a, you know, minor project of more or less Lewis Post and his wife for many years. But honestly, it's in some ways it's probably better than many major publications today.
Yeah.
You know, the print media is, you know, in a decline, and they're only you know, so many outlets that are left standing, and many of them are, you know, their resources to engage in serious journalism are disappearing. And I think, yeah, a lot of the articulation of, you know, political belief is now happening outside of them through means like social media that are, like you said, much more ephemeral. It's hard to say, you know, what sort of task historians of the early 21st century will have ahead of them. I'm just hopeful that there will be to write histories of the 21st century, you know, be a 22nd century to write it.
Let's hope. I guess I wish that, like, I mean, talk about, like, kind of little journals. I mean, I kind of wish that you could just, like, mandate the people, like, oh, you're ordered to make a little journal. You talk about, you know, Lewis Post and his wife, but, like, reminds me of, I mean, I'm fascinated by kind of the dead ends of the American left in the 20th century. It reminds me of Dwight MacDonald and his wife running the Politics Journal in the, you know, from 1942 to 1948 or so. Because, like, I just read that cover to cover, and it's just such a great snapshot of that era in a way that I just wish that people would be curating thoughts and stuff into kind of a snapshot of this era and so on. But I guess we'll see. Yeah, I think that bet does it here. But yeah, thanks so much for making the time for talking about the book. The book, one more time, is Land and Liberty, Henry George and the Crafting of Modern Liberalism. If you have any, you know, kind of last words, you can go ahead.
Not really, just thank you for having me.
Okay. Yeah, thank you so much for being on. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
Cool.
We have been talking to Christopher England all about the book Land and Liberty, Henry George and the Crafting of Modern Liberalism. You can find this episode, as well as all previous episodes of this radio program, at the website seethecat.org. This is a presentation of KZSU, Stanford.